Welcome to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast, presented by the Biohacking Village. Each episode will explore DIY bio, citizen science, and medical device security with guests from the healthcare, cybersecurity research, and biohacking communities. Hosted by Nina Alley and Bo Woods.
Hello, welcome to White Hats and Lab Coats podcast. How are you, Nina?
Hey, friend. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm just watching you dance to our theme music. I love it. Every single time, it gets a little better.
This is what people who don't come to our live studio audience don't get to see.
I know, which is such a shame, right? If we did something live and that music played, I would sit in shame.
Be awesome.
Yes. Okay. So we have an amazing human on today, and we've done a couple of other things today. Every time I talked about this person, they did jazz hands and immediately said, "Tell them I said hi," because just the wealth of knowledge that this person brings in, I absolutely amazing. So I'm going to introduce them since that was a long way to say you're awesome. So Young B. Lim is here. Hey.
Hey.
So I'm going to just recite a little bit of your bio, then we're going to dig in and then we're just going to have conversation about stuff. So Young B is a member of the Baltimore Underground Science Space, also known as BUGS, a community-based lab in Baltimore, Maryland, and a doctoral student at George Mason University in the biodefense program. What? We're going to talk about that. I'm actually going to read your whole thing because it's just amazing. He won't shut up if you ask him about his DIY bio origin story. Safety, security, society implications related to DIY bio and community labs. His love of homebrewing rice wine. Yes. RuPaul's Drag Race. More yes. Board and video games. And his numerous trips to South Korea. How can you not love this human? Yes. So, first things first. What do you want to talk about? Because there's a lot. We can talk about RuPaul's Drag Race and just like leave everything else out of it.
I'm going to let, you know what? You have invited me to this gracious space and I really appreciate it. So I'm going to let you decide on what you want to talk about.
Okay.
All right. So one of the things we need to plan, we've been discussing a little bit, what is the beer that we're going to have as the official biohacking brew? What is the biohacking rice wine going to look like this year?
I'm all for this because I don't drink beer. So.
So like a Korean rice. You know, a Korean rice wine has this really beautiful kind of sweetness to it and effervescence, but also it tends to have a bit of a yogurty tang, almost kind of like the lactobacillus really working its way in through the system. But sometimes what people do is they actually, instead of using water, they use tea to infuse the wine with additional flavors, like, you know, it could be like chrysanthemum flowers, you know, all sorts of stuff. So I don't know about you, but since spring is right around the corner, we're hitting the whole entire cherry blossom season. How about like a cherry blossom infused rice wine?
Yeah, I love it.
So Bo is nodding enthusiastically. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go with the yes. So DEF CON, the Biohacking Village, is in August. So we need to plan accordingly for quantity and quality.
And transport.
And transportation and how to keep things cool and effervescent. Yes.
Yes.
So while that is a thought process in your head, the way that you and I bonded was at MIT's Global Bio Summit. And particularly, it was over the community science labs. And your PhD is based on the needs and the resources and the things that our people, the citizen science folks, need. So what is your exact focus? Or not exact, just what is your theory behind your PhD?
Yeah, so I think I'm going to talk about my motivation for the PhD to kind of get it started. And it's fairly succinct. I think that you have two very different portrayals of do-it-yourself biology and community labs out there right now. One is driven by kind of more conservative security and media people that see this community as a threat, because with increased accessibility to equipment and knowledge, people could do all sorts of crazy things, is essentially what this group is saying. And then there's the DIY bio community itself, which says we're self-regulating, we're safe, we're not trying to do anything dangerous, we're just looking for things to do so we can educate ourselves, empower ourselves, because biology really is the future. You know, we're seeing a huge boom in biotech and we want to be a part of it. The thing that I found troubling, though, was there's no real data necessarily to corroborate one way or the other. There have been studies in the past, like the 2013 study by Todd and Dan and Piers Millett, you know, looking at the seven myths and realities of DIY bio. But I decided to take a different approach. I wanted to look at why people get involved in community labs, how the community labs are organized, and how people learn in these spaces, and use that as an opportunity to build information and understanding about community labs so we can maybe come to some good, you know, practical discussions based on empirical evidence as opposed to just speculation.
So who's the we in your sentence?
That is a very good question in terms of, I think the we can sometimes change because I wear multiple hats, right? So on the one hand, I'm a biosecurity person. I'm very interested in keeping the nation and the international community safe when it comes to the life sciences. On the other hand, I also see the potential of DIY bio and biohackers and the community labs in educating people, trying new and innovative things. And so sometimes, you know, the we, I feel like, encompasses all for me because I feel like I am a part of both of those communities. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what I want to see is a bridging between the two. So maybe we can leverage community labs better. Maybe we can enable biohackers to do things in a safe and good fashion that can assuage the fears of the more conservative, you know, individuals.
So let's talk about the assuaging of some of the individuals. How are you discussing or meeting with policy folk and saying the citizen science people, the DIY biologists are not terrible? We're not trying to come up with new ways to do whatever you think it is we're doing. How does that conversation progress? And do they ever go into the lab and actually have a conversation of, I'm here to learn, I'm not judging anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, that definitely has been happening on my end. I've been a little bit logged down with all of the data that I've been getting from, I'm essentially calling this a community-based project, because without community lab buy-in, I would not be able to enter these spaces and have the interactions and the information generated that I have. So, you know, huge shout out to, you know, the DIY bio community labs that I've visited across the United States. Counterculture, BioCurious, GenSpace, Boss Lab, Bugs, Biologic, Indie Biolab, Open Biolab. You know, these and others are such great community spaces, each with their unique kind of ecology. I love that sometimes I just kind of talk and then I just completely lose my train of thought.
It was policymakers. It was about the policymakers. But wait, while you're right here, so, while we're talking about the community, the community science, I love that you just name dropped everybody, because I think there needs to be more knowledge and notice of, at least those are the American ones for right now, right?
Right.
And one conversation I had with Dino Ramey.
Yes, absolutely.
Love her. I had a very long conversation about how the community labs are not really, how are they working together? Are they working together? If you have a resource and I need a resource, will you give me that resource? How do we pool money? How do we separate the money? There's a lot of hierarchy where we're all trying to help each other, but we are still individualized. Is that something else that you're addressing?
Yeah, so there are a number of people that I interact with on a fairly regular basis in the more kind of traditional national security area. So, you know, there are a number of mentors that I, you know, talk with. There are a number of kind of policy meetings that I go to, that I attend. And, you know, in an opportunity, any opportunity that I have where I feel like community labs are not necessarily being represented fairly or not being represented at all in the conversation, I, you know, go up to someone and I go, hey, so have you heard about these things called community labs, you know, X, Y, and Z? And I you know, you gauge their interest. If they're not that interested, you just kind of move on, you leave a card. But, you know, some people, they're like, you know, hey, Youngbi, I know that you're really in with these community labs. Is there a probability that you would be able to introduce us to those spaces and maybe take us sometime? And so I'm arranging a couple of those right now, actually. With, you know, some, you know, pretty prominent people in the national security arena. So if you're from the national security community and you've heard about community labs, but never visited one, and all you've read are about how community labs may be contributing to, you know, a lot of fear and concern related to, say, bioterrorism or bioweapons, I really urge you to reach out to me or other members of the community. I'm more than happy to, you know, set up connections. If you're interested in particularly in the Washington, D.C. metro area, BUGS, which is the Baltimore Underground Science Space, I'd be more than happy to arrange, you know, a tour and meeting leadership there. Or if you'd like to talk with me just more about community labs, I certainly am available for that as well.
You have this traditional security, national security, biosecurity background.
Right.
You've talked about how amazing the biolabs can be, the DIY biolabs. Mm-hmm. What helped you jump that transition? What helped you make that transition from like national security to then look at this you know, potentially untapped potential to go and try and want to harmonize those two things together?
So you just touched on one of those topics I won't shut up about, which is my DIY bio origin story. It starts in 2015, where in a course in the biodefense program at George Mason University, fantastic program, you should check it out. I was taking a course where someone happened to mention things about the DIY bio community, how it's a community that's poorly overseen, has a lot of access to cutting edge technology and knowledge, who knows what they're doing, and therefore they are a cause of concern. So I was very much in a very traditional, how do we mitigate the threat mindset? When I first encountered DIY bio, jumped to 2016, where when I end up in California for a research assistantship at Lawrence Livermore National Labs, and I meet Patrick de Hesselier, who also works at Lawrence Livermore National Labs as a bioinformaticist, but is also a co-founder of one of the community labs out there called Counterculture Labs. And he learned that I was interested in community labs. And he said, so I know you're interested in community labs. Have you ever actually been to one? And so I said, I never have. And he took me to this, you know, space in Oakland, California. And it was the first time I'd ever seen, you know, this kind of lab setup that was atypical, but clearly it was functional. There was a whole bunch of like kitsch and equipment just all over the place. But it was also just seeing the people there and seeing people interacting and going, hey, how can I help you do the project that you want to do? Or how can I help you research the things you want to research? And it was that community building that really attracted me to that space. And I really haven't looked back from there.
Did you, you said you were looking to counter threats. Did you initially see these DIY spaces as threats to be countered, or did you not know about them, or were they just kind of in your periphery?
I think that for me, the fortuitous element here is I happened to run into someone that was more than willing to invite me into their space. So the mentality there for me became less, how do I mitigate the threats associated with these spaces, so much as let me just experience what these spaces have to offer. You know, trying to go in more with an open mind, you know, leave a little bit of that security mindset to the side. And, you know, as time progressed, and as I've been doing my dissertation work, I don't necessarily see a lot of the threats that individuals tend to say in terms of like bioterrorism threats, bioweapons threats. You know, there's a lot of complexity associated with those types of programs that I don't necessarily see in community labs, particularly in terms of resources, in terms of motivations, in terms of how they're organized and that facilitating those types of activities. It's a necessary thing to do, though, this dissertation, because it then allows people to actually go, we have some raw data we can work with to then, you know, arrive at kind of empirically based assessments as opposed to just assessments based off the gut.
Can you give us some concrete examples of where there's either actual examples of helping to prevent threats or potential examples to prevent threats coming from the DIY bio community?
So community labs actually function in pretty tight-knit organizations. Everybody tends to get up in everybody's business because it's a fairly small space and everybody tends to know each other and all of the things that everybody does. So that in and of itself, I feel, is a pretty powerful deterrent in terms of kind of biological-based threats. It doesn't mean that someone's always looking over your shoulder, but at the same time, someone, more likely than not, any week that you're there is going to ask, hey, how's that project you're working on ongoing? What's up with that project? You know, could you explain your project to me? And just that kind of scrutiny alone, you know, I think mitigates a lot of threats. Also, a lot of these community spaces, actually all of the ones that I've gone to, have essentially an institutional review board. They research all of the, you know, projects that are proposed. And often what happens is they always have a safety person that's sitting there, as well as a number of other people with expertise. And either the project is approved, the project is not approved, or the project is approved with revisions, mm-hmm. right? And often these revisions take into account the limitations of community labs and kind of like the safety issues and the security issues. So they, you know, sometimes even find better ways to do a project than the person had initially proposed, and simultaneously it's safer too. So, you know, there are like a number of examples like this that I see community labs implementing.
Yeah, that's the self-regulatory nature that you referenced earlier. Are there mm-hmm. any projects where you think that you know, community labs might be exemplary for helping solve other problems in biosecurity, or other potential threats to biosecurity? Like, for instance, with the COVID-19 outbreak, I know that there are a number mm-hmm. of community efforts around that. Do you see that as A, helpful, B, an outlier versus something that's increasingly normal?
So I believe you're referencing the Joggle effort currently, where they're trying to get community labs and biohackers together to find faster and better ways to identify COVID-19 cases. I think that there is a trend in community labs because people just want to better understand their environment. I think there is a space where community labs can do a lot of research that traditional and academic labs aren't as interested in. So kind of understanding what is in the general environment. So actually Bugs has a project like that too, where they're trying to figure out what all on a genetic level is living in the Inner Harbor, a major body of water with ecological significance. So I think that there definitely is something to community labs in terms of understanding the environment and also being able to share that information. And also, I think there's also, they're trying to leverage biohackers and just average citizens through another Fold It kind of like game, where it's trying to generate, you know, the next vaccine or mm-hmm. or treatment for COVID-19. The one concern that I would say, I would not want people in community labs handling COVID-19 samples. especially since none of them, for the most part, none of them actually that I can think of off the top of my head, should be able to handle those samples from a safety standpoint. They don't have the safety rigor necessary and the safety levels necessary to be handling samples. Okay. But if it's, you know, I think that there are ways that community labs can contribute.
Yeah,
but just like, not.
They can provide scale to where it maybe falls below the threshold of traditional labs where you need biosecurity clearances and all of the other safety protections. If it doesn't require that, then equipping the community to go out and do these things can actually advance the state of science more rapidly than you would be able to otherwise.
Right. And, you know, a lot of the things that community labs do, I think, are like not, you know, one person that I've talked with pretty much says it's not sexy research. it's the research that you can't get funding in academic institutions because it's just not paper worthy.
Right.
But, community labs don't necessarily have those same incentives, and curiosity can have people doing really interesting things.
So from your travels in the labs, have you seen a lot of level one or level twos, or is there anything above that? Or are people doing stuff in level ones that are level two?
What does level one and level two mean?
Yeah. So do you want to talk about that?
So I'm somewhat familiar. I don't know all the technical details, mm-hmm. but I often think of there are like four essentially safety levels that are dictated by kind of biosafety experts. You consult the CDC, you know, all of these kinds of institutions. And the first level, which is the most basic level, is BSL level one. Often people say that that's the equivalent of, say, a high school lab or maybe like a, you know, really cheap college lab. And then BSL level two, you're able to do certain other types of work that you couldn't do in BSL one. So most of the work actually in community labs is BSL one. A lot of them actually, from the top of my head, I think 8 out of 10, that I've worked with and mm-hmm. visited have BSL one facilities. And then there are two that I can think of off the top of my head, one of which is Biotech Without Borders and one of which is Counterculture Labs, that are looking to do more cell culture line stuff. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of advancing more towards BSL one plus / BSL two spaces.
And then three and four are even beyond that.
So three and four are pretty much you don't, I have a very difficult time thinking that community labs would ever get to that point. Often those are levels where we're dealing with pretty nasty or
it's like bunny suit infectious. Level.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty nasty stuff once you start getting into BSL 3 and BSL 4.
You say nastiness. That's obviously mm-hmm. a very technical word, but are there more specific things that determine three and four?
Yeah, so part of it is the novelty of the particular organism. Mm-hmm. Part of it is also the infectivity, so how infectious right. something is, as well as what its mortality rate is. So how often it kills in terms of percentage. So those are a couple of the factors that go into this kind of tiered system for okay. biosafety levels.
So you talked a little bit about IRB, and before you talked about IRB, I had written it down. So there's a group of biohacker folk from different labs that have started to get together and constructed this IRB methodology because they're trying to figure out if we can do it as a whole rather than just mm-hmm. as each area by itself. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So I think that actually I remember one of the people that might have presented on it was at this last Global Bio Summit, Sarah Ware,
yeah.
who is the head of BioBlaze, mm-hmm. which is a community lab based in Chicago or the Chicago area. And I think in theory, it's a fantastic idea. I'm all about community labs finding ways to pool their resources because I think the community is stronger when it can come together and pool all of those skills and resources so that you can really get the best you know, you can really have the most input and the best outcome, I think, if you could manage that. I do question the feasibility in the sense that it's, you know, it's difficult enough for individual community labs to operate just because there's so much burden on the leadership to be able to keep a lab going. There's so many concerns, like, you know, where am I going to get my reagents from? How am I going to pay the rent? You know, how many classes should I be organizing? And how do I reach out to these people? Community labs are basically built off of the backs of one to two to a small group of leaders per community lab. Yeah. And, you know, the difficulty there then becomes, well, if you add one more thing onto the backs of these individuals, is it going to be a sustainable activity? And I would like the community to ask that question first before they go really like hot and heavy in on this.
Valid. So I wanted to touch on something you mentioned earlier about how you do work with the policy folks and the government folks, and on the other side of this is the citizen labs. But do you ever get to a point where you either have a sit down with them and they can have a constructive communication, or are they still, or have they ever been of the mind that, you know, I don't want to have the conversation with them because of whatever reason? So where are we as a community? Where are we at the point to having a sit down with government folks?
So I think in the past, particularly with the FBI, there have been a number of sit down occasions. I think a lot of that has continued on a very, very low level, at a very local level with community labs. I feel like community labs, in terms of the potential threats they may represent, kind of just comes out every few years. It's just kind of a chestnut that the media and maybe some more conservative security experts might want to bring out, for a number of reasons. In some ways, I feel like it's the lack of communication is a problem, but I also don't necessarily see it as bad, because it means that at least for mainstream security experts, there's not enough of a need to deliberately go calling to community labs to see exactly what they're doing, to pretty much like make sure that they're following all of the rules, you know, all of this stuff. I would like to see more interaction, but I just don't think that the need and the desire is necessarily there yet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. but that's just me.
I have an internal question, and it may not bode well. So I might move my chair away from Beau for a little bit. I think, or I feel, that the person you were talking about on the government side that had a lot of interaction with the citizen science folks was Ed Yu.
Yes.
Okay. So I think a lot of us know who Ed Yu is. He's really amazing. He understands our mindset, and we can have a normalized conversation with him. But I think he's either, I know he's still in his organization, but he's got like a sidebar with something else going on. And I don't think that anyone else has taken his place. Or if they have, I don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I always loved about interactions with him was he was very open. Tell me what's going on. I want to know everything in a paternal sort of way, but just I want to know everything, and I want to know how I can help you, and I want to know all of these things. So does it make sense that not just his organization have someone in that capacity, but other organizations that we may have interactions with have that sort of person, where they have sort of a citizen science group activity where we can also be part of, and we can generalize conversation rather than that formidable chat space?
Right. So in terms of the first bit about not being sure who has replaced Ed, so Ed has and always will be an advocate for the DIY bio community. He does it pretty much every day. I actually saw him this past year at Bugs. We didn't plan it, but he just happened to be there and we just caught up. But his kids were also doing agar art,
which
was super awesome. Yeah. So he's all for these spaces. Ed's successor is Will So. William So. So there have been a number of times where I've actually reached out to Will because there's like a starting community lab that didn't know who to contact in the FBI. So I just connected them with him and things seemed to go fine.
Okay.
So that's good. So it's not like the seat is vacant. There are eyes on this. One institution I would particularly love to have more connections with, and I think that, you know, there's definitely a little bit of interest, at least because I don't know if you're familiar with Gigi Granvall at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security.
No.
Yeah, so she's awesome. She does a lot of work on kind of the bioeconomy, but also I think she sees the good of community labs and she sees them as a resource. And so I would love to see, say, more interactions, especially since like Bugs is right there, for example, mm-hmm. and Hopkins is right there. I'd love to see a little more interaction between those groups just to see if we could have some conversations, get more of those relationships going, but also see if there's like a niche that, you know, community labs might be able to fill that health practitioners think, oh, you know, that would actually be a good gap for community labs to fill. You know, I think there must be some, you know, especially since we're talking about, yeah, I think that would just be a really good connection to establish and build, especially since, you know, Hopkins is a pretty big,
yeah, they have a really good program.
Force.
So how can we as the Biohacking Village and as community members help with this endeavor?
I think what it is, you know, when you see some of these kind of biosecurity people at conferences, because they're always there, right? Yeah. Like, you know, you always see the FBI stand. You probably see, you know, someone with a Hopkins badge or something. Don't be afraid and like introduce yourself, because I think a lot of the misconceptions that exist about community labs is because sometimes it's just about not knowing the other side, what the other side is doing, what the other side is like, and not seeing them as people so much as seeing them as problems, right? Or potential problems. So when you start building those like human social relationships, you know, the trajectories of what you see with that person and what they might do just change, because that's just human nature.
Yes, I love that. We're gonna leave that there. So people, not problems. That's how we're ending this. Thank you for being here. You're awesome. Keep doing what you're doing in the community because everybody loves you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the White Hats and Lab Coats podcast presented by the Biohacking Village. Find us on iTunes, Google, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Join the community conversation and expand your gray matter on Twitter at @DC_BHV and get transcripts, links, and show notes at whitehatslabcoats.org.